Music New South Wales presents Sound Advice, Dial a Crowd, Touring, Marketing and Building a Fan Base. Featuring musician Ali Bada, Stephen Wade from Select Music, Dan Medlin from IE Music, Clara Iaccarino from Perth International Arts Festival and Make Believe Productions, and hosted by Mark Dodds. For more information and for other upcoming panels, head to www.musicnewsouthwales.com/soundadvice.
The theme of our panel tonight is Dial a Crowd. And really the whole theme of it is, I'm in a band, I've started playing live, I'm doing some shows, some people are coming along, but I'm not necessarily making any traction. What are the next steps? How do I grow into bigger rooms? How do I get noticed by more people? How do I get supports? So to answer these questions, we've pulled together an expert panel of fabulous people who've worked all across the industry. So I thought I'd just start by maybe we just go left to right over here, and starting with Dan, maybe you can just introduce yourself and say who you are and what you do.
Great. Hello, everyone. So my name's Dan Medland. I'm a managing director at IE Music, which is a management company. We have bases in London, LA and Sydney. I'm English, as you can tell from the accent, slight twang. About 7 years I've been here. We manage a range of artists, Robbie Williams, Lady Hawk, Gin Wigmore, Passenger, and all the way through to sort of emerging artists like Winterbourne and various others. So whole range, some domestic, some international, and very fortunate enough to work on a whole broad range of talent.
Ali.
Hi, I'm Ali Bada. I'm a musician from Melbourne, and that's it. That's all I have to say about that.
I'm Steve Wade. I own a company called Select Music, which is an agency based in Sydney. We look after over 100 odd different acts. I'm the agent for a range of artists. I look after Rufus, Boy and Bear, Passenger, Client Liaison, Josh Pike, San Cisco, Seth Sentry, Thelma Plum, to name a few.
Same
I don't look after your one, though, personally. But someone from my office who might be here today sitting in the crowd also looks after the amazing All Our Exes Live in Texas. So there's a connection there between some of us up here. And we also have a touring company, and we've done tours like Panic at the Disco, and we're doing At the Drive-In coming up, and David Duchovny next year, my personal favourite actor.
Clara.
My name's Clara Iaccarino. I am a manager and festival programmer. I work for the Perth International Arts Festival as the contemporary music programmer, and I manage All Our Exes Live in Texas, Mama Kin Spender, We Two Thieves, and I think that's it for now. That'll do me.
All right, perfect. Well, Ali, you were the least talkative of the bunch, so I'm going to start with you over here. I guess the best way to start about this, I guess, is to talk about the artist, because the artist is the first thing that's there before we have managers, before we have agents, before we have more managers and festival programmers. Can you just tell us, you know, you've had a really great year, you know, been played on Triple J and had feature album and touring nationally. Take us back. Like, can you tell us about your first shows and where they were and how big the rooms were and who was there?
No one. I started playing open mic nights, so they were my first shows. And then I sort of, like, the bars that I played at after a few nights would say, do you want to come and play on Sunday afternoon for $50? And my mum would come, and one of my best friends would, she's been to everything. But I kind of didn't want people to come because I was shit. And, you know, I was shit for a long time. And then I just did that. I just kept doing that. I really didn't know what to do. So I just kept playing those gigs, and then gradually that gig turned into playing with other musicians, which meant a band, which meant that I would play bigger venues. I don't know. And then I sort of met other musicians, and they would ask me to support them. And then
Playing solo to start?
Playing solo, playing acoustic guitar for a long time. And then gradually, I think I sort of expanded out into a band after I recorded an EP and had to, you know, play that live.
I'm going to apologise earlier. I used to be a journalist as well, so excuse me if I do interject.
Remember whose panel it is tonight.
I know, you're the boss, but look out. I was just going to say, Ellie, you say a long time, but can you actually define a long time? Like, how long ago were you playing those open mic nights?
Like, from the time I was like 21 till I was about 25, and then I put out an EP.
Could you just name, I mean, a couple of venues that you played about Sydney and Melbourne still there? Like, could you name a few places that people might know or recognise that you play?
In Melbourne, I'm from Melbourne. So there was a bar on Carlisle Street called Pause Bar. They had an open mic night. The Great Britain has an open mic night. The ESPY played a lot of Wednesday night midnight sets at the ESPY in Melbourne in the front bar, those kind of venues.
Was there a moment for you that was like, wow, I don't know that person and they're at my show? Like, when did you first realize you had fans, or did you actually have a team come on board around you, whether that be a manager or an agent, before those things kind of started to develop?
I guess I didn't have any of the people around me until I put my stuff up on Triple J Unearthed, and I won one of those festivals. And at that festival, Laneway, my future manager and my future booking agent was there. And until then, that was when I was 27. Until then, I didn't have anything. I was just playing gigs by myself with my band and to my friends and supporting my friends, basically. It wasn't until, you know, I put out an EP and it got played that I started to recognize familiar faces at gigs, but no one special. Like, no, just people were coming to my gigs. You know, it wasn't like...
I think that's a jumper over into what other people here on this panel do. So, Stephen, I guess Dan being a manager and Clara being a manager and Stephen being an agent, my general experience is that I find that more often than not, a lot of artists seem to have agents before they get managers, but it also happens in reverse. Like, there's no set rule to it. Stephen, what are you as a booking agent looking for? Like, how are you discovering live artists? Are you finding them online and then going to see them? Or are you standing at the back of a bar, you know, kind of lighting up a cigarette and looking out for that next big thing band that's going to take you all the way to the top?
He's not going to be in the back doing BOC.
Thanks. Dan and I share a very special relationship in which... we enjoy giving it to each other on regular occasions. Not in a...
Verbally.
Yes. Well, for me, quite often I've had discussions like this where that kind of question gets asked, and it is so ridiculously diverse. There's some great expressions I've heard over time that things like talent finds talent. So a lot of the times... someone tells us about somebody that they've seen. A recent thing for us was, I look after an act called Busby Maru, who very successful. They had a number one debut album this year. They've had a gold album. And their manager said to me, we're doing their big album tour, and he said, we want to use this act called the Teskey Brothers. And he said, you should really check these guys out. Like, they're amazing. And so we checked them out, and they were amazing. And we jumped straight in there before anybody else did. So we look after them. And they came on that tour, but they've just sold four corners out in Melbourne. So they've done 3,000 tickets. And they'd been around for like 7 years playing in pubs and cover gigs and all this kind of stuff. So Rufus, I went to see a band in the side stage of the Oxford Art Factory, and Rufus was the support band. And I actually liked them more than the main act, and I went up and got an EP off their manager, which only 2 months ago, someone brought up the fact that I didn't pay for the EP because I used my, hey, I'm a agent guy, and I got it for free. So I sent them a $10 note just with a, you know, probably not going to make much difference with how well you're going at the moment. But and a lot of things come to us from, have a listen to this, you know.
Cool. So, I mean, even outside of people who aren't represented, if you're a band who's just starting out and maybe you've done one show over here and you want to begin getting on the radar of potential managers and potential agents and people who are around town, would you advise they just go out there and ask for any possible gig and play as many shows as possible? Do you have any advice as to how a band who's just starting to play live can get more live shows?
Yeah, look, one of the things that we talk about a lot is that until you really have a profile... every gig is a good gig, because when you get a profile, there's a whole lot of mechanics and things that go on behind the scenes in the music industry that are really important. So once you have a profile, we want to make sure that you're not overplaying, that you're actually playing the right places at the right time. Before you have a profile, you're not really known outside of maybe a handful of fans or your friends or loved ones or whatever. So it doesn't matter if you do 10 support slots. It doesn't matter if you play open night mics. You know, none of that stuff matters. realistically, it's just about getting out there and playing as much as you can and understanding what your craft is and how to excite an audience and how to connect with an audience. The one thing that I've loved in my whole time of working in the industry is that it's very rare that someone who's really talented doesn't get on anyone's radar, because now it's so easy to discover that, you know. I've had acts where a manager or an artist has talked to us and said, you know, I'll have a listen to our song on Spotify, and I go on and they've had a million streams, you know, and I'm like looking at it going, they've never been played on Triple J, and, you know, and I look at that and go, that's incredible, because there's no filters anymore in the music industry. You know, radio doesn't control things, record labels don't control things. We actually control it, you know, which makes it really unfiltered and very true.
So if you were a band and you were just starting off and you want to get on people's radars, do you think it's okay for a band to just play for free, just to ask for shows? I mean, there's no issues with that?
Yeah, look, I mean, at the end of the day, you just want to get out there and play. If you're getting bogged down in the schematics of thinking that you need to get $200 or $500 or $50 or whatever, no one makes any money out of a music career. The artist, the manager, the record label, the agent, in the first kind of year to 18 months, no one makes anything.
Sure.
I'd extend that a little bit past the 18 months, to be fair. I think I just wanted to add on to the playing for free thing. I think, you know, there is a culture that does need to shift, I think, in terms of what people are paid for certain things. And I think there's a larger responsibility to a lot of artists when they reach a certain point to perhaps honour that emerging artist rise a little bit more. That's something I'd love to see happen a bit more. I'm talking mostly about massive headline artists that come out here and offer $200 for Australian local bands to play. I think that sucks and I don't think it's necessary. Thank you for already getting me fired up. But I just wanted to add, though, I think...
She might be talking about me.
I'm not talking about anyone in particular, but it is a little bit too common. So therefore, yes, play for free in the beginning, but also set the bar when that standard needs to tick over. And I think the exposure thing is something that you can put no price tag on in the beginning, because you're building a community, you're building your profile. And I think what Ali was saying about people started to come, I was playing with my friends, that's about the community that exists within this room. So everyone here, already right now, there's probably about 100 people here. I'm not sure if you all play the same genre, but it doesn't even matter. You can create a mini festival right here, right now, by meeting everyone that's here, exchanging all your details, and straight up, you should be going to each other's shows, and that's how the community builds. I ran into a friend who's here tonight who used to play at an open mic night that we used to run 10 years ago in a venue called Bar Me in King's Cross. I haven't been to King's Cross for a while because I don't really live in Sydney anymore, but I have heard it's died a bit of a slow death. But I think what we did create there was a community of people who are now all around and still play with each other. They're in each other's bands. Ruby's our love story. He married someone that he met at that open mic night, and they now have a little record together. So it's all about that little community stuff, which I think a lot of people criticise Sydney for not having, but I think it's testament to the fact that there's 100 people here tonight that there is that still around. So that's how you start it.
I might jump over to Dan for a second. So, I mean, this is actually a really great segue, because Passenger was an artist that kind of came over to Sydney and just really begun. I mean, I'm trying to remember the first two or three Passenger shows that I saw in Sydney, but in very interesting, small, intimate venues. Can you tell us a little bit about how, when Passenger kind of relocated here, or at least was spending a good deal of time, how did he go from being someone who was just busking on the street to someone who all of a sudden built an audience? And what was that process like for you as his manager?
Well, it was largely due to him. I mean, ultimately, I think with any true talent, and I mean talent beyond sort of artistic talent, I think you need someone who is willing to do absolutely whatever it takes and to do everything they possibly can. He came over here for 9 months of one particular year, purely on the back of it being great weather to busk in. There was no master plan to any of it. He came over here, he built a fan base off the street of Martin Place and in Manly Corso and various other places. But it was bit by bit by bit. It was connecting one by one with people. Facebook was something that was starting to be really relevant at the time, back in maybe 08, 09, in terms of an artist channel to connect with. And he took the approach that he would be very personable, and he would build one-to-one connections with people. So he would reply to every single message, and he would do all the things that really made people want to be part of what he was doing. But it was all from the street. There wasn't our first show in Sydney was the Revel, which doesn't exist anymore, but it's the 70 cap room above the what's it now?
Is it Harpoon Harry's?
Harpoon Harry's. Okay, so Harpoon Harry's. I don't know what it was called at the time, but Harpoon Harry's had a bar upstairs, and we had a 50 person gig up there, which is sold out. And then it built up and built up to a point, and it was all from busking. There was no radio. Triple J did not love us, and have never loved us.
That's Gemma Pike from the last panel has left now, so good. Now we can really okay. put the foot
it's
in.
It's all good. They can't love everyone. Just on the Triple J front as well. The reliance on this industry in this country about Triple J is a bit insane, I think, personally. And there's a real danger of being... This is a real segue. I apologize.
It's okay.
But there's a real danger, I think, of everyone being fixated on that. And you don't need to. You don't need to. Passenger is a wonderful example of a commercial artist, a mainstream artist, who hasn't used that channel to get to where he is today.
I'm going
to
jump in again. Dan, didn't Passenger also connect with a lot of artists like Alana Stone?
Yeah.
He really tapped the community. Yeah. He had them featured. Josh
massively,
Pike.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the Flight of the Crow album, which is the one that he recorded in 2010, when I first moved over, he did exactly that. Yeah, Lior, Josh Pike, Katie Noonan, Alana, Boy and Bear. Exactly. And it was a wonderful, yes, speaks wonderfully to your point. It's exactly that community together helped you know everyone and some of those songs today, talking about streaming, some of those songs today have like 26 million streams, and it's incredible. It really is.
And also Dan, I became Passenger's agent because Josh Pike took me along. I'm Josh Pike's agent. He took me along to the show saying, you've got to see this guy. He's brilliant. I'd never heard of him. I'd never seen him busk. And I saw him at Notes at Newtown, and it was sold out, and I couldn't believe it. I was like, this guy's sold out 300 tickets, and I'm, you know, in the music industry, and I've never even heard of him. So.
This is like a eulogy to every dead venue in Sydney that no longer exists. It's quite depressing the more we run through
so
it.
So whilst the music industry, the venue industry, shit.
Also got the lands down back.
Don't start a venue. Just have a music.
So in a practical sense, like I feel like if you're an upcoming artist and people are like, oh, community and work, like in very simple terms, as a manager, if someone just arrived off the street and says, I play this kind of music, I want to do shows, what should I do? Like, would you advise they just... You know, should they just start reaching out to bands they like and find out where they're playing or who they can talk to? I mean, how do you break into these communities of... How did Passenger get Matt Corby and whoever else was on his first EP, who was on the Flight of the Crow?
That's interesting. Again, that's just people and connections. It really is. It's all people. All of this is all people.
But did he just start going along to shows and introducing himself to people that he liked? Did he start emailing people and ask if he could support them? Like, what do you remember what Mike did to meet such a... Because if you look at Flight of the Crow, it's before he broke, but it's got Boy and Bear on it, Matt Corby, all really before any of these bands went on to do anything.
Kate Noonan.
Incredibly eclectic, but you just saw within a matter of very short period of time, he really had embedded himself amongst the singer-songwriter community in Sydney.
Yeah, it's a bit of everything, to be honest. It was a bit of me reaching out. It was a bit of him personally via Josh, actually, and then via a good Nick Boscia, who was Lior's manager, who sort of came on board as an executive producer and helped put a lot of these connections in place. So it was largely to do with him and Mike's tenacity and people like Josh sort of helping out and thinking this was a cool thing to be part of.
But the busker spirit is amazing too, because Passenger is the most successful example, but the Pierce Brothers, Tash Sultana, and there's 123 agency in Melbourne has built a bit of a thing around picking up these buskers, and I think that again talks to the tenacity and the determination of how a craft and a career is built, because buskers know how to perform, and I think that's probably the key to what we're talking about also about this live thing, is honing your craft so that your live show, which is one of the only things that you can still control in terms of, you know, the fall of the label, the, you know, streaming services that apparently don't give us any money but actually do create touring circuits for us, because you can see where people are loving your music.
But, I mean, obviously as well, not everyone can busk. I mean, a lot of things we're talking about, open mic nights, busking, playing these things, these are very suited to a particular genre. And obviously if you're in a, you know, a grindcore band or a death grind band or a death metal band, that might not necessarily be the right thing for you. But I do think there is an overarching point in talking about communities, because every scene inside any given city has got a number of bands who are playing regularly and people who like that music. And it is quite easy to find people's details, to reach out to them, to send them your music, just... ask, hey, can I come and support you next time? Or next time you're at the show, you know, go up and talk to them. People are very approachable, and it often turns out that if you are an artist and you're out there putting yourself out there live every day trying to make music, you can relate quite well to other people who are doing the same thing.
Tell the manager when you support them that you're going to bring 20 people to the show, because you've got a community of your own that they don't know about, and that's selling tickets for them. So that's
but, the plus. But actually bring 20 people.
Yeah.
Because if you don't, you end up with everybody going, they're the people that tell you they're going to bring people and they never bring people. So
Clara, you obviously managing bands and stuff, let's get out of the local bubble. So, you know, you've done your first show, you're getting more people in the room, you're playing Brighton Up Bar or whatever. I want to kind of talk more broadly about the country and about touring as opposed to just playing gigs. When, I mean, there's a whole wide country out there. As a manager, when did you know was the right time to take, for instance, Omaexes from playing just in Sydney to going and doing a show in Melbourne, or to even going out to regional areas and doing stuff there? Because as I'm sure, Ali, we can come back, but touring is quite expensive, I hear.
It's very expensive.
Well, it's also very expensive if you're four people rather than one. So it's, you know, the start off for Ali to have started solo is enviable to a band such as All Our Exes Live in Texas, which is four women. I actually came on board as the manager for the band when they already had quite a good thing going. I first came across the girls because I know Alana Stone from way back. We both attended the seed management workshop together. She was as a self-managed artist. I was as a very, very green manager, managing an artist called Fergus Brown. We met up there, and then I'd been watching her sort of career develop in different ways, and I was very struck by this project. I gave the girls a support show with Mama Kin at the Brunswick Music Festival, and I also booked them for the Darwin Festival. But then the difficulty of then coming on as manager and then looking at the touring circuit and looking at the expense that you know, the investment phase, I think I chimed in pretty early to say the investment phase continues for a lot longer, and, you know, making any money in the first little while can be challenging. But I think the time when you look at making that step outside of Sydney, for example, which is where we're based, you know, Brunswick Music Festival was a great opportunity for the girls to get down to Melbourne. And I think being part of festivals is obviously the dream gig, isn't it? Because you're playing to a set crowd. But I did actually start managing the girls after they did the arena tour with the Backstreet Boys. So I was circling very effectively, and that was the clincher for me as a child of the 90s. I was a little bit struck by the fact that these guys were going to open for one of the biggest pop bands ever. So I started working with them, and the first thing we did together was go to Big Sound. I think we'd been working together for about a week, and we're sitting down at tables with international folk, and I'm freestyling our international strategy as we evolved to have these conversations with people. But we are now touring internationally because these four women are four of the hardest working musicians you will come across. I think Passenger is a great example of that too, but these guys keep me on my toes absolutely. We started a Slack group. I'm not sure if you guys use that app, but it's changed my life. I think we got the stats in yesterday that we'd sent 200 messages in a day to each other about a whole variety of different things. Like, they just do not stop. And it's great, but it also means that, you know, you have to work as hard as they are working. And taking on that, the touring thing, is because they want to. They want to find new fans. They want to connect with new people because they've outgrown Sydney to a point too.
Well, look, I want to go back because speaking of the Backstreet Boys, which is a segue I didn't think I was going to have to make during this talk, I thought it's actually a really good opportunity to talk about supports, because supports for any artist getting into, pretty much any artist who's going to get started, you do not start doing your own headline shows. You start on bills, supporting other artists. So I guess maybe it's best to just start with Ali and just, I mean, do you remember who your first support shows were for? And also, I mean, in all the supports you've done, you know, when you're making a decision about whether to support someone, especially interstate, like, have you ever lost money having to go over and support another band?
I constantly lose money. That's pretty much what I do most of the time.
So what I guess I'm keen to know what goes into your consideration. Like, for an aspiring artist, what are you looking for to know whether doing a support is the right decision and whether it's worthwhile?
Well, I mean, when I first started supporting, I was supporting my local friends' bands, and, you know, obviously I wasn't getting paid for that, but I respected that band. So I was like, yes, I'd like to support you at your show that is at the Tote and there's going to be 50 people there or whatever. And that was my attitude. And then I think my first support was for Daniel Merriweather, and I almost fell off my chair when my booking agent called me and said, do you want to support Daniel Merriweather? And I was at the corner and I opened for him and I just respected him as an artist. And then the first tour I ever did was with Katie Steele. And I knew of Katie Steele and she was going interstate and there was a chance for me to get my music heard. And I couldn't afford to bring the whole band for the whole tour. So I played some of them solo and I played some of them as a duo. So I just sort of like made it work for me at that time, you know,
Were the decisions guided by the fact that obviously you're playing to huge rooms because, you know, you're not going to walk into the corner very easily on your own.
So totally. Oh, my God. I was just stoked to play, like stoked to be asked first and then stoked to be playing these big rooms. And then, like, the Katie Steele tour was sort of small size rooms, but I was excited to get on the road and play other cities, you know. And
what I always think about with supports is that whenever you get an opportunity like that, the key to it all is making sure you have a strategy afterwards. Doing a support slot on in of itself is great, but it won't in of itself build an audience. What you need is another connection point. And I think you need to say, right, I remember the tour we did with Mike and Boy and Bear. They were sort of breaking what they were sort of doing, 500,000 cap at that time. And Mike was first on, I think. But we'd just started working together and we set up another headline run maybe 2 months afterwards. And that was vital in building an audience here. So you've always got to think as an artist, I think as a manager, whenever you have an opportunity like that, which is great, the next step is the step. Like what you're doing now is only the part to the next step. Because live, there is always step after step. And you have to try and think quite far, even at a small level, quite far in advance to capitalize on opportunities like that, I think.
Well, Dan, I might jump over on that. So let's say that you're a new band and you get an opportunity to support a, let's say you're supporting another international band at the Oxford Arts Factory and you're the opening act. Yeah. What are some small steps that you as a manager would suggest that a band takes to ensure that they get something lasting from that? I mean, should they be throwing stickers out to people? Should they be sending out a huge press release about themselves with a campaign? What would be a small achievable goal that you think a band can walk out of it and say, that was worth it?
Okay, so keep your set as short and succinct as possible. Never overplay. It's the killer of all support acts. I think even on big stages, most support acts, unless they're really well known, I would say 30 minutes is max. Mm-hmm. Honestly, it's in, it's out, it's do your thing.
Because you're making it a showcase.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's exactly that. And people just don't know you. So you can't expect them to sit there for longer than that, I think. Definitely, I'm an old school flyer person. I love a flyer. I think people, there's still something tangible about that. And you need to be accessible to the audience. You need to go out at a time into the audience after your set. Depending on the headline, I normally would say to acts, go out after the main support is finished. Go out and meet people. If you don't do that, you're missing a huge opportunity. You have to go out. You have to meet people.
Can I add one thing? Bring a mailing list. Yeah. Old school, sign up at the merch desk. Get the people's email addresses who are there and liked you.
That's actually really good advice. It's incredible, I think, just make, like you said, making yourself accessible to people and giving people an opportunity to come and say hello to you and to sign on. There's a lot to be gained there. And I think often people can just say, come and like me on Facebook. That's a lot less personal and you won't necessarily get as much. Dan, you actually said just a minute ago, keep it short, keep it sweet. Mm. Do you have any other advice as someone, if you're putting on a passenger show and the support band rocks up, do you have any other advice that you could say to a new band that if you get a support, you want to get invited back, don't do this?
Be really easy to work with. Prima donnas do not last long. Be understanding of where your position is in the whole scheme of things, because I tell you what, crew in this live situation is so important. And if you get crew who you're being difficult with and you think you should deserve this and you should deserve that, it's the killer. Absolute in that situation. So you've got to be really easy to work with, and I think be on time, of course. I know this is a given, but it really isn't a given as well. Be on time, be punctual, be easy to work with, and just be, you know, open and affable, I think.
Be nice to the sound guy, be nice to the lighting guy. They're probably working there 5 nights a week.
But never, ever, ever play over your set time. Because if you're to finish at 9 o'clock, but you then stuff your set up a little bit and you go, but our biggest song, we've got to do that, and we finish at 9:05, I can guarantee you that will set off a chain reaction of the crew people that Dan talked about going to Dan, the manager, who then will go to someone like me as the agent or whoever had that act, which then has to go back to their manager. And it just causes, you know, it's the most disrespectful thing that a support artist can do is chew up or stuff up times for the person that everybody's paid to see, you know.
Yeah, and I mean, one thing that I've noticed as well from running live shows, we had an incident where I also think just respecting the backstage area and the green room and knowing that it's not your area necessarily. You know, we had an incident where a support artist played and then led all his friends back to come and say hi, and then something got stolen out of the main artist's green room. They're all saying it wasn't them, but, you know, it's like people aren't supposed to be there. Something goes missing. Who's going to get blamed? And that's a support act which, you know, isn't going to work with us again. So, you know, there are incidents. There are things just to think about when you're doing that. Gravitating away from supports for an instance, Stephen, let's say that a band is up to the point, you know, they've done their supports. They've just played a Brighton Up Bar and they've sold 80 tickets or whatnot. And, you know, so the band's about to release a new single. They've just sold 80 to 100 tickets. When do you judge that it's time for a band to upscale to the next room? When does what makes you think now I want you to go to Oxford Arts Factory or now you need to go to, like, what should they be thinking about?
I think the process for any artist from, you know, when you're first starting out and doing your own shows before you kind of enter the wonderful music industry world and get connected with industry people, agencies, all those kinds of things. I think the whole pathway of everything that you should be doing is based around you perform, you entertain, you connect with those people, and then as the managers have said and Ali said as an artist, you try and create a connection outside of your live show that exists beyond the live show. So whether you've got bits and pieces and little kind of blurbs or Instagram posts or things that just connect those people further to you and get a better understanding of the artist and the artist's personality. Because the thing I've always believed as someone who's worked in the music industry my whole life is that we connect with artists because of what the musical message is to us. And each person is a completely different person. So we can, 500 of us in a room hear the same song, but we all process it differently. And some people take that incredibly emotionally, you know, to heart. Some people are pissed out of their minds and don't even know what they said. Some people, you know, love the message or whatever it is. But the fact is that everybody goes home with a different message. So why I always felt someone, say like Mike and Passenger, was so successful is I would see people in the audience and you could see their brains ticking over with each song and no two people would be experiencing it the same way. So, you know, once you build that up, once you get to, say, being able to sell 100 tickets, that gives us as an agent a little bit of ammunition to then use that momentum to on-sell you into something else. So if someone was going to, if you had an international support, Dodzy, and we were going to ring you up, we'd be using those kind of key statistics to go, well, you know, you got to have a bit of buzz to be able to sell out any show. So the key for me that I would say to any artist is if you can play, say you can get 80 people to a show, go to a venue that holds 50 and sell it out. And then as soon as the sold out sign goes up, if you can sell another one, then do the other one and come to us and say, I sold out two blah, blah venues. It's not about the capacity. It's about the fact that you as an artist are creating a demand for yourself and that demand follows. I mean, when we first started looking after Boy and Bear, it's a ridiculous stat, but that band from when we looked after them started in like 200 cap rooms. We sold out every single show they did for 3 years up to the Sydney Opera House. And that was 100% across Australia. So every time, like when we could do the Horden Pavilion, we did two Enmore theatres, you know, because we wanted to sell the first one out so quickly that everybody lost their shit and then burst in to get tickets for the second show.
Well, I mean, you just mentioned before the Teskey brothers in Melbourne doing Four Corner Hotels. I mean, by the sound of things, they could have just done a forum in one night, but it...
Oh, well, they could have done Festival Hall because yeah, they've sold 3,500 tickets. But it's our job to manipulate momentum. Amy Shark's an artist that I've been looking after recently, and she's She sold four corners in 2 weeks. So she did 3,500 tickets in 2 weeks. We could have done six or seven, but our platform was we were advancing 6 months, 7 months ahead, and we were talking to the promoters that were doing the Sia tour. And in our mind, Sia was a real commercial pop audience. So we agreed that we wouldn't put more tickets on sale so that we wouldn't cannibalise both those markets. And we went for that and balanced it off. But every and we ended up doing, rather than a metro, we've done three Oxford Art Factories, three Woolly Mammoths in Brisbane. So it's people like the excitement of having a bustle and get in there for a ticket, you know, and it breeds a buying pattern, you know, from an early age as a fan.
And that can go right down, like you say, it can go right down. The same principle is applied from tiny up to huge. It's exactly the same principles.
I think it's really good to know what Steve's talking about, because it's actually, he won't own it himself, but he's talking about strategy essentially, and I think that's what's really attractive to building your career. And I think what Select does really, really well is work with artists that aren't just relying on Triple J. I know that we had the radio panel was before us and they talked a lot about it, and I didn't see the whole thing, but I work with artists that haven't been loved by Triple J, and you know, Dan.
This was
the
actually the next
thing.
Question I was about to ask you, yeah. Clara. That so yeah, to reflect on this, so please continue.
But I mean, Amy Shark isn't it? Exciting and incredible example of someone that has shot to stardom with one song. So it's an excellent example to look at and hope for and aspire to, for sure. But I think what's even more interesting and probably more relevant is that Select has a really excellent strategy about building the career, and based on what Steve says, is because you create the need and you create the excitement, you create this buzz, which, you know, essentially you could sell out the news agency, which I think is, you know, they've moved and it's 50, 60 people, whatever it is. But a sellout is has that certain caliber to it. So with my festival hat on, when I talk to agents, you know, I don't really like to say, you know, how many tickets are they worth, but you do have to sort of ask that to know. And it doesn't necessarily guide all my booking principles, but it does give you a bit of a story as to what they have been doing and how they've progressed in the ranks. So the other thing to note is that obviously being in Western Australia, not every artist can even make it over there, and it's taking a lot longer for some emerging acts to come to WA. So I'm having an interesting position. I'm in an interesting position where I can go to somewhere like Big Sound and see a lot of bands that, you know, are selling out corners and are doing great numbers in Sydney and Melbourne, but have never been over to WA because it costs a fuckload to get on a plane with a band that's a four-piece or a five-piece to do that. So if you're going to lose that much money before you make the distance, it's a challenge for you, unless you can be paired to something like the Perth Festival, which we do have budgets to help people. But that said, I think the bands that actually make the challenge to come over to WA are creating a really good touring circuit for themselves, because the music scene over there and the fan base are so passionate about music that, for example, two of the girls from the X's actually studied at Whopper, so they always had quite a commitment to get to Perth. And you know, it's not always that we can find a show that gives us a guarantee or whatever to make that, to take the flights and go the distance, but by committing to that territory, you know, I'm calling it a territory, it actually is a whole other territory because it's not on the East Coast run, you then there's so many places you can play up and down the West Coast that, you know, they're screaming for music.
Ali, I wanted to jump back to you for a sec based on what Clara kind of said before, you know, saying that, you know, I represent bands who Triple J haven't necessarily been super, super friendly to or haven't wholly embraced but building around it. I mean, before what you described, all the way from starting playing solo at open mic nights to being an artist who's played regularly on Triple J, you know, that's been quite a long gestation and something that's grown really organically. When you were starting, you know, if you had booked yourself a show at the Tote or the Northcote Social Club in Melbourne, these are very small rooms, you know, 200, 300, they're even smaller places. Let's say that you did it and you'd sold 120 tickets and you're thinking, how do I sell more? You know, I've reached out to my immediate community. I've done these things. When you were independent and doing things completely by yourself, can you think of any really basic marketing or things that you would do that can help just reach out and get the message out there?
I don't know if I played any show, my own headline shows, before I had people on board. If I was playing with a group, I guess we would just use our community. It would be Facebook. It would, I mean, I don't know.
You've never, for instance, previous to you having a manager, you never got a publicist on board. You never did Facebook ads or anything for your shows? Okay.
Because I didn't know about it. And I didn't know it. I didn't have no idea what I was doing.
Yeah. I think one of the things that's important with that kind of stuff is it's good for Ali that she'd never had to do that, because there are a lot of people in our industry that will take money from you to do services that you don't need. You know, and at the end of the day, I understand that there's a desperation to share your creativity with the world, and most people really want to try and get in there and kind of do whatever they can or pay whatever they have to try and get somebody to do that. But, you know, the proof in what Ali's saying is that she went out, did what she did, but she's a great artist. And so someone then discovered her, and then other people discovered her, and then, you know, you form a team around these great artists, and hopefully you've got the right team around you and it moves you forward.
Yeah. One quick thing, just in terms of strategy to sort of help sell out shows. We were talking about it just earlier. Passenger and Old Man River did a joint headline run, and we were playing the Annandale, which, again, unfortunately,
rest
no
in
longer
peace.
With us. Yes, there is a slight theme, isn't there?
He also played the Gaelic Theatre.
Yes, he did. The Gaelic.
Doesn't exist.
God, what is it about him playing venues and them going under?
Healing.
Okay. Kiss of death, maybe. But what we did, we've been very he's always been very good about visual content. So he's always created a lot of videos, and this is probably one of the first ones. But we did a cover song of Tiny Dancer with Old Man River and Mike and a bunch of others, basically replaying the film from the famous what's the title of the film where they do it in
Almost Famous.
Thank you. They did that. They created this visual piece of content that was really funny, had them both in it. And it was one of the key things I remember us both remarking on that really helped sell that tour through. And it's just one example, but you can come up with creative ideas. It doesn't need to be cafe posters, and they're all fine, but it doesn't need to be that. You can come up with creative ideas about how to sell your tour or your show, whatever it be. It was just a relevant thing between two artists doing something funny that people connected with. It's about creativity, not just on stage. It's outside of that as well. Yeah.
Can I just also add, I worked with Mama Kin and Fergus Brown for years, and then when I started working with the X's, they were the first band in Australia that I took on a booking agent. So I booked all the shows for all those artists before that. And I think it's also worth noting in terms of you asked for some marketing ideas and things
just
like that.
If you had $200 burning a hole in your pocket, you want to sell some tickets to eat, does anyone have a quick, something that you'd recommend?
I think, Facebook is so effective, and what you can achieve for such a small amount of money, if you really get in there and like fine tune how you do the ads and how you boost your posts, you can really target your people quite well. But it's also, again, you've got to tap people who you know are going to go to gigs. Like, other musicians should be going to other gigs for the same reason that you are. You know, you're hustling and you're bustling, but you also see and love music. So it's kind of finding ambassadors out there. So, you know, if you want to give away a ticket, for example, maybe you choose five people who've got a loud mouth or will also put it on their own personal Facebook page, so it's not just coming from the band. And so you say, guys, I'll give you each a ticket plus, you plus one, if you, wrangle and tag five other mates, and then all of a sudden you start that snowball effect that's within your own circle, and it's not just constantly being pushed from your band page. It's actually on influencers and other, friends that aren't just seen as your friend pushing the band.
Well, look, thanks everyone for being here. I figured for the end of this, we'd just kind of throw to some questions from the crowd. I might start with this one because it's a nice little question. Ali, someone's asked here, what's something you wish you knew when you started? Can you think of like one bit of advice that Ali Barter of 2017 would give to Ali Barter of, what were we talking about, 2012? I'm trying to count back 5-6 years.
2012. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Things like Facebook. I mean, I don't know if they had Facebook ads back then, but they're hugely helpful now. Social media, I didn't know how to use that back then, but now it's just so good. I don't know. I guess it was more maybe don't get into debt.
Okay.
Because I did that. And I think it's kind of unavoidable, but I think you can not be dumb like I was. I did get a publicist on board once and spent all this money when I didn't need it. Like, there was a time when I was like, I want a manager and I want a publicist and I want this and I want to do it all, but I didn't need it. You know, I just needed to keep playing my gigs and doing my thing. And so I think you can avoid that if possible. People will spring up around you. If you have a community around you, someone will notice you, and then it will happen naturally.
One of the great things I think about the people who are on this panel, who are managers and agents, is that often the people who are really going to be there early in your career are people who are working on commission. So they're people who are invested in your career, and if you grow, they will grow. And I think that what Stephen was probably trying to say before was that, you know, I think in the early stages, you should always be looking for people who are willing to invest in you with their time and take a percentage and have ownership of your growth, as opposed probably to investing in a publicist for an upfront amount of money when you may not need it. Dan, how long were you working with Passenger before? Well, it says selling out rooms, but let's go past the Raval and thing. Like, when did you look at Passenger and go, wow, this is a hard ticket artist in his own right? We're not orchestrating these small 50 cap shows just to pretend sell them out. He's actually selling stuff out.
First time would have been Gaelic, I would say. 500 people in Sydney.
750.
750. Yeah. Christ, undersold myself. There we go. All right, 750 people. Yeah, I'd say that was, I can't tell you what year that was, though, I have to say. 2011, maybe. Roughly.
Yep.
So Mike had been with the company, not under my stewardship from the off, but with the company, oh God, he's 16, 17. So he'd been maybe with us 7 years prior. And he was that magic age of 27. You mentioned 27 earlier as well. There's something about the age of 27, by the way, that is remarkable.
You either die or become very successful.
Yeah, I'm serious. It happens to so many people. It's like, how old were you when it started? It wasn't necessarily your whatever it's going to be, but it was like it started to snowball. 27 is remarkably accurate. It is that thing about spending the time of an artist that's going to have a long-term career that 27 just makes sense. I don't know why.
Would you say? I mean, it's to do with a human, you know, maturation as well. I think like you're getting to that age. Like, you know, I think there's a die-hard level when you're in your early 20s or you're 18, 19, and you just go nuts and you drive from Melbourne to Sydney and back again in one night or whatever you do. But I think 27 is a shift in, you know, it's an awareness of the industry as well, which I think is, you know, give or take it, there's evil things about it, but it's also that strategy, that clicking to also look how am I building my team, all those kind of things. I think you're starting to take life seriously or choose not to be an artist anymore.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And I think it's I think also just going back to the Passenger story a little bit, we had a huge failure before we started growing again, by the way, just so everyone thinks this is all roses. It is not. We had a huge failure. The first album was a disaster, and it was a lot of money put behind it. We were doing this whole new deal, which was sort of venture capitalist funds and all this sort of stuff back in 06, this was. Many, many hundreds of thousands of pounds because it was in the UK. And it failed miserably. And it took that journey for Mike and myself hit absolute rock bottom with the whole project to then build it back up. I remember having a conversation. I was like, because we were supporting him at the time because it was all wrapped up. We were supporting him financially. The best thing we ever did together was to take away any of that sort of safety net. And I think it's really, if you can take away a safety net from yourself, if possible, I think it really helps, because the ones that really swim are the ones that make it. And we took that all away, and he said, right, how am I going to make money? And at that point, he said, right, I'm going to busk. And that was back in, 07 maybe. And then from there, we gave him $3,000 to make Wide Eyes Blind Love. He bussed with that record for the next 7-8 years maybe, and sold over 50,000 on the streets, roughly. So many on the streets, just by hard graft. And that was his little journey. So in terms of the amount of time, yes, it's a long time, but it was really the journey that was the more important thing, I think.
Well, talking of a journey, there's actually the question, six likes up here. So a lot of people are wondering, and this is for you, Ali. Look, this is a real how long is a piece of string question, because there's no real answer, I guess, for this. But in terms of an artist who's working on recording music, you know, you want to be an artist, you want to be a successful band, and you know you've got to have recorded music, and you know you've got to play live, and to play live you've got to rehearse, and in order to get people to your show you've got to start getting people in your social media. Is there something in how you operate that you see how you divide these things up? Like, do you feel like if you're an artist starting, you should be putting all your work into making a really great song recording and getting that out there before you start thinking about live, or should you be ready to back it up before you go?
When I started out, I just wrote as many songs as I could, and it was all about writing songs for me. Something shifted for me one year and I decided I was going to write a song a week for a year, and I just wrote song, and a lot of them were fucking awful. And I just wanted to write songs. And then I guess that was my main focus. And then once I had a grasp on that, I just wanted to play shows. And that was the other thing. Like, I played open mic nights because it was free. I didn't have to get booked. I could go every night of the week. I was too scared to busk, but I open mic night somehow was different. And so I went open. So they were like my things now. And now it's the same. Like, the song is the most important thing for me. If I have a tour, then we book in a bunch of rehearsals. It's sort of just.
So it should be, as you know, it really should be as the artist. Like, I think the divide your time stuff, I think you can get so caught up in trying to divide your time doing that when actually the key thing is really. You know, we say it and it sounds so boring because we do say it all the time, but honing your craft and being the best that you can be, whether it's in your garage band or whatever, or it's the busking, that's actually your key responsibility as an artist.
Ali, I mean, this is a question. When you were writing all these songs, are you thinking about how they might be performed live when you're doing it? Like, do you think that an artist should be thinking when they're writing all these songs for themselves, shit, I better actually be able to perform this? Because, I mean, I think also, and going back, the panel who's here, especially the artists we've been talking about, Passenger, Ali's early stuff, All Our Exes Live in Texas, a lot of this is music which I guess translates to a very, can be played intimately, can be played solo, can be done, you know, in very simple formats. I'm also just thinking about people out here who might be making electronic music, people here who might be making, you know, more complicated forms of rock music or whatnot. You know, do you think it's important for an act who's starting to have songs that can translate into the live sphere, you know, just in case?
Oh, I mean, definitely. I think the lifeblood of the industry is live music for me. I grew up playing live very badly, but I grew up with that, and that's always been what I've always resonated towards. So I think for me, live is... Every rule is broken in industry all the time, right? But I would say generally, you will really struggle for a long-term career if you can't have a live element to what you do.
I think that's particularly for electronic music. You know, Mark and I have an intimate example of it, but I think, you know, it's no need to name names, but there is a lot of people flipping a laptop and dancing with a microphone, and sorry, but I just can't book you to do that. So you've got to think of...
Why not? I gave you all my great stuff.
Give it to me. You're amazing. Put the hat backwards and we're on. But I think... I've got a huge, huge stage for the key stage that I booked for the Perth International Arts Festival, and it's a capacity of 1,400. And there's great electronic artists out there, but at Big Sound last year I saw quite a few that just did not have a live show. And you can do some really interesting things quite cheaply and effectively, and that's, again, tapping community of a different variety. It's get your audiovisual mates to make you killer projections, then press play on your space bar and off you go, we're off. It's great.
I was going to say, like, with that question about what should you do and allocate your time and all that kind of stuff, I, like a lot of people, started in the industry. I played in bands. I did all that kind of stuff. I think the thing that I've learned the most over all the time of my career is that the reason you play music is because you love it. What fucks it all up is when you start thinking about all the other stuff. So really my advice, the best advice I give to anybody as far as how you allocate your time, do it for the passion and the love of why you started in the first place, which is to make yourself happy. I mean, that's why any of us create music, because you create it by yourself or with a group of people, and you all look at each other and giggle and laugh and feel good about yourself or whatever. If the rest of the world likes it, that's amazing. If they don't, who gives a shit? I mean, you didn't get together with only the purpose of conquering the world. And if you do and you don't get there, then you end up really bitter and pissed off, and you forget the reason that you started, you know. And there's lots of artists that I've worked with that never reached enormous great heights, but they're incredibly humble, they're incredible musicians. I've loved every show that I've ever been to of them, and I wished that more people thought they were brilliant and they sold more tickets and sold more records and all the rest of it. But, you know, there's only X amount of slots in the world and Australia where the biggest acts can be in the middle and the starting out and all the rest of it. So I kind of say when you're starting out, really just kind of relax and just love what you do and don't hustle people too much. Don't send emails to music industry people with a whole, like, 10 songs on them and saying, listen to this, and then calling us a prick if we don't, you know, all of that kind of stuff. It's not good.
Well, there's actually quite a few questions kind of in this space about supports at the moment, Stephen, so I may stick with you for a second. Let's say that you're not hustling, you're not constantly throwing your stuff out there to everyone involved, but let's say that you hear that a band that you love is coming to town and you think, fuck, I might be able to be the opening support. Maybe I'm not a huge deal, but maybe I can just be the person who's there when doors open. Can you just quickly explain to people what, like, how an unsigned band with no agent might go about getting in contact? Like, can you explain what a promoter is, for instance, to people and how they might find out who that is and how they might pitch themselves to be a support act in a respectful way?
Okay, well, the crassest kind of answer to that question, as you would know because you're a promoter, is that 9 times out of 10, the agent, the manager, the promoter doesn't decide. This woman right here does. The artist chooses it. We can suggest artists, we can put people forward and all the rest of it, but the music industry isn't that kind of ugly and aggressive behind the scenes where, like, 20 years ago when people did really control that stuff. I mean, these days, you know, from our biggest artists down to the smallest, 9 times out of 10, the artist is, we might give them a list and the artist will go, you know, or sometimes the last San Cisco tour that we did, their manager said to me, you know, we did the run and he said, okay, so blah blah is going to do these shows and Stella Donnelly is going to play this one and Thelma Plum was recording in New York and became best mates with Scarlett and they want her to do the tour and then they started talking to each other. So it's, again, it's one of those things that if you, you know, cold calling and all that kind of stuff, it's tough to do in this industry, you know. I mean, my suggestion would not be to not do it, but to understand that it's probably more likely you're not going to get a reply or a response from somebody within the industry.
But by the,
no.
Sorry.
By the way, I was just going to say, it's the same for us as managers. And I'm off, you know, there's occasions where I'm having, you know, some of my younger artists, I'm sort of pitching it away to you. 9 times out of 10, it'll be no. And it's really not, even though we've got a great relationship, I think.
We did until they swapped the photos.
So they swapped the photos, yeah. It is very much about the artist and what they want. So We do. I'm in the same boat as some of you guys a lot of the time.
So what you could do is if there's artists that you really like, hit them up directly with a song.
David Duchovny directly with your song.
He would
can't
love
wait
it.
To meet him. I've got to tell you, I just want the photo, you know. Like, but no, seriously, one thing that is massively important is send your best song, one song. Never send more than one song to anybody. If you send one song to me and it's brilliant, I'll send an email straight away going, what else have you got, right? That's how it works. It's discovery. So you'd be better off if you like 10 Australian acts, hit them up on Facebook, go, hey, if you're ever looking for a support, yeah. You know.
I just want to qualify what I said no to Steve about is not about the artist making the decision, it's about hitting up the manager. I've got a little folder that I keep when people send me a proposal to do a support, and I really do try to answer every email that I get. I'm failing miserably this week, but particularly when there's an emerging artist that does hit me up, and I take it to the girls where I think it's appropriate and as often as possible, but they're inundated too. But I think every now and then you do have that little gem, and it's also in different markets that you might play into where you need some help from the local acts there to hit it, and you wouldn't have heard of them. So for example, we're playing a show in the Gold Coast next week, and we need some help to sell some tickets there. And I've had a number of artists from the Gold Coast hit me up, and I don't know who they are, and I will listen to them, and we need them. So,
well, one thing I think that Dan kind of struck at, and that you guys are saying that's really important as well, is not taking any of it personally. A lot of the emails you may send out aren't going to get responded to. That doesn't mean anything in particular. There's also one of the interesting things about supports that you'll also find is, just because you like this person and you sound like this person, or you see do, often that's a reason that a band doesn't, like, you would be surprised with some of the bigger bands that we tour. You know, it's like the National or Fleet Foxes will say, supports, we do not want an indie folk band. That's the last thing. No acoustic guitars. We want a comedian. We want a drum machine. You know, Japandroids came out recently and requested, you know, we had a lot of rock bands come to us, male rock bands, and Japandroids are like, we want female vocal acts. So there are often reasons that people don't select you that really have nothing to do with how you may sound. It just may be about the contrast of what they're trying to create with the show.
It's a really good point, because I also quickly became the lady folk singer manager, and I can't manage all lady folk singers. So it's also, because you do sound like it, it's actually can count against you. So be creative. And I also think there's music lovers on this panel here that probably love a whole variety of different kinds of music.
Just trying to get through these really quickly. We've got a question here about the festival circuit. Ali actually mentioned that the way she kind of broke into live stuff was she uploaded some music to Unearthed, which anyone who was in the previous panel we talked about a little bit and was very lucky and won a competition and wound up on Laneway. It's quite a lovely story. Clara, you program for a festival, Perth Festival, which has a whole bunch of international bands touring. How do you advise that bands who just break into this kind of interesting and eclectic world that is festival programming, do you have any advice in how to get on people's radars like you or, you know, other events?
It's a tricky example because, you know, it's an international arts festival and I do the contemporary music, and as I described to you, my main venue is a capacity of 1,400. And there are very few bands in Australia that can fill that capacity in Perth on their own anyway. So I do program a lot of international artists. But because I'm really interested and committed to breaking emerging acts, I've been doing a lot of double bills. And I've also been really keen to bring over acts that haven't ever played into Perth because they couldn't afford to be there. So I do accept unsolicited emails. Whether I can respond to them all or not is the next question, but I do accept them all. And when I am fortunate enough to get another staff member that comes on to help me, we program a local stage outside of the auditorium, which is a free stage. And mainly we were putting Perth-based acts on that stage, but also I'm open to people who want to, you know, take the punt and do what Ali said. And, you know, if you can be featured in the Perth International Arts Festival program, it is probably something worth taking a punt on and losing a bit of money to get over to Perth to try and do. Probably not if you're a five-piece or a four-piece, but if you're solo or duo, I think it would be the kind of thing that you would consider. And, you know, I'm happy to give people my email address. I dare you to spell my last name.
I definitely think on the festival question that it's something which very naturally follows bands' progression. If you start playing with other bands and you start doing supports and then you can sell a few tickets and you start to get more visible, festival bookers will start to sniff around you and be interested. And it is often, playing a festival seems like a really good opportunity, but, you know, I'd also find that, like Dan says, it's great to get in front of people, but you need to be able to get something lasting for it. And so it does seem like one of those things where it's good to have a team and something you can gain.
Yeah, just to follow on, really. I think there's a slight over-reliance a little bit on wanting to get certain slots at certain festivals, and it isn't the be-all and end-all. Let's be honest, you're going to be up against a huge number of people on a great artists on those bills, and that's one piece of your puzzle. It is not getting a Laneway slot, amazing, but it's one show. And it doesn't make or break an act, I would say, on the whole. I think it's about building everything to get to that point, and that's just another stepping stone in the road. It's not the festival slot that is the be-all, I think.
But you're better off with something like, I don't know how many people in the room are familiar with Parlor Gigs, for example. Those guys are absolutely killing it with the model that they've created, and I think really high-profile artists are now doing that. And I had a chat to Matt, who runs it, the other day, and I said, my artists really want to do it, but we're suddenly scared that everybody's doing it. And how, you know, how are we now going to cut above to even feature, but he was saying that the fan base are the ones that actually
what's Parlor Gigs,
shows.
Clara, just for anyone who's not familiar.
So Parlor Gigs are where there's a host, it's essentially house concerts, but they've also built a model where they play into any venue that's not a traditional venue per se. So I think their definition is that it can be anything from a living room to a hall, and so any venue that's not licensed. So they don't do pub gigs, but they do any space. For singer-songwriters, and also I think actually for any genre that wants to just play shows all across Australia, they can do tours, and they now work into New Zealand as well.
Well, I think we might actually be out of time. There's still a couple of questions left. I mean, when it's like how long should artists play for free before moving to paid gigs, I think what Stephen kind of said before was really interesting. I think the answer is just kind of when you think you can sell the tickets in the size of room you're in is probably the time you can do it. And if you don't think you're ready for it, but, you know, stay small and try and sell things out.
Yeah, and I've kind of been of late having a bit of a bitch in the industry about how cheap tickets are to go and see bands. So, you know, young artists that are getting to a point where they can do a show and people are going, oh, it's got to be $10. And I go, so you'll pay $10 to see a whole night's entertainment and then you go and spend $9 on a Corona, you know, it's kind of like, and you'll go to the movies and it's $22 and it could be Baywatch, you know, like, so the balance is really out of whack for me. Like, it was $10 to see a band 10 years ago, you know, whereas I'm trying to push our artists when they get to a point, because if you get to that point where you're selling tickets, you might only get to circuits of Australia in a year. So, you know, if you put your ticket price too cheap because you think more people will come, I think you might be kind of underselling the intelligence and the passion of your audience, you know.
It's beautiful advice. Thank you, everyone, for coming. I'd like to thank the panel for answering all these fantastic questions.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone.
Appreciate it.